Hello.
I'm August.
And I'm Kendra.
And welcome to Book Dumb, the bookcast brought to you by a couple of dummies.
So for today's episode, we are focusing on translations. So works that were originally published in a language other than English.
Yeah. And this is one that I feel like we've been wanting to do since we've even started talking about the podcast. But when preparing for this, I realized that I have not read enough works by authors written in another language. It's very limited.
Ditto, dude. It's a real problem.
Yeah. And I mean, like, I feel like I'm vocal about my love for American literature. Like, that's primarily what I read. But damn, this just made me realize how much of a problem that ultimately is.
Yeah. And it also made me realize, I was just saying to August, that I don't pay attention to, like, whether it's translated, which is bad. I should pay attention to the original author. But there are a lot of books on this list that I just didn't think of as translations until, like, I saw them pop up on, like, the Google of translated books. And I was like, duh, I should have known that.
But, are there any that aren't on your list that you had that experience with that you want to name now?
I don't know. I'm sure off the top of my head, I can't think of. But I think all of the ones on my list, there are two in particular that I'll mention that are on the list. I was like, I had no idea this was even a translated work.
Yeah. I feel like I have the same experience for, like, a lot of the books that I've had to read in school in the past. So, like, I'm looking at my bookshelf right in front of me right now, and I'm looking at a stack, and I know literally all of those works are translated from a different language. And I didn't even think of them when I was working on this list. Like, Don Quixote is right there. A bunch of, like, Jungian psychology is there. Another Don Quixote and, like, Homer. It's like, yeah, come on. But didn't even think of those.
Yeah. You know, Canterbury Tales was listed as a translation.
I mean, is that, that's medieval, right?
Yeah. But to me, I'm like, it's Old English.
Old English. Yeah. I mean, some universities, for their, if they often require people to learn a second language, a lot of people take Old English as a way to meet that requirement. So,
yeah, but I think the reason I'm like, the Old English they're learning is, like, the Beowulf Old English, and Canterbury Tales is a little bit closer to, like, Shakespearean English. Yeah. So I think I was just, like, triggered because I was like, this shouldn't.
This write a strongly worded letter to that list.
I will, like, Google.
Hey. Google, okay. We're coming for you. Yeah. So in this episode, we each have 5 top favorite works that have been translated, as well as 3 honorable mentions and some ones that we would like to read in the upcoming months.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah.
Maybe not upcoming months. It's impossible for us to stick to a TBR. So like the next year or so.
Well, speaking of reading, what are you reading right now?
Oh, nice transition. I am reading Stoner by John Williams, and it's not about smoking weed. Don't worry, everybody. It's about a very sad academic taking place in Missouri in the 20th century. It's like dark academia dreams. I'm 70-ish pages in, and I'm loving how depressing it is.
Sounds like a stoner.
It's so good so far.
Okay. I remember seeing this book at Green Apple and going, August, you should get this one. You're like, I just bought it.
I already had it in my hand. I'm like, dark academia, depression, evaluation of one's life and purpose? Me. Love it.
And it's called Stoner.
Yeah, it really is me. But his name is Stoner. I am just a stoner. That's okay. What are you reading right now?
I'm actually reading a translation, not planned, but what? Happened.
Totally planned.
It actually was not. I wish it had been so that I could have finished it, because I think it's something that might have shown up on this list. I'm very early into the book, but it's Ithaca Forever by Luigi Malarba. I'm sorry that I butcher every name of all kinds. And it's translated by Douglas Grant Heiss.
Mm.
And it's, obviously it's about the Odyssey and Odysseus, but it's mostly from Penelope's perspective, who love. Yes.
Oh, I love that. That reminds me of the Penelopoyad by Margaret Atwood, which is only, like, it's a so-so book. It's decent, like maybe a 3 out of 5, but that one sounds tight too.
It's beautifully written so far. But I'll update you all, especially you, August. I had you in mind when I bought this.
Oh,
it's your boy.
So happy. Odysseus, what a guy.
Yeah. All right. So should we get into the ep?
Sure. Should we start with naming our honorable mentions here?
Yeah. Do you want to guess? Oh, sorry.
I was just about to say we each have three. Do you want to get us started or should I?
Sure, I can get us started. My first one is The Stranger by Albert Camus, which was originally published in French. The reason it's an honorable mention is because I haven't read this since I was 16. So I read it in high school and I remember loving it. But
I read The Stranger in high school?
In AP Lit.
Damn.
Yeah, I want to reread it because I remember loving it and being really just like stoked about it. But I can't remember much else other than like what happens at the end and the plot and stuff.
The sun. So, do you remember the sun?
I don't. Like
the actual sun in the sky. He is an important element.
Okay. Oh, doesn't he talk?
I can't remember. I read that my freshman year of undergrad.
Okay. Honestly, no idea. I do remember some spoiler things that I'm not going to say, but I didn't feel like I had an accurate memory of it. So I didn't want to put it on the big list.
Okay. Totally cool. I really like Camus. We'll be talking about him a little bit later. So my first honorable mention is No Exit by Jean-Paul Sartre. I love No Exit. This is a really fun play. This is actually the first play of his that I've ever read. And I've since read a number of them. Usually there's like, if you have a No Exit in that collection, there's going to be at least three other plays. Highly recommend them. Some not as cool as you would hope, but they were written in the 40s by a French guy. So let's just keep that in our heads while reading. I actually don't know who translated the version I had. I looked through the book that I have. It's behind me somewhere. Right here. It doesn't even have the translator on the cover. And I was like looking through. I just have the standard No Exit edition. I'm sorry that I don't know the translator's name. But this book is three people are in hell together and shit happens.
I love that play.
It's so fun. I'm surprised that you like something from this time period.
I know. So far, it's like the only one I have. I love the whole hell is other people. Like, people are hellish.
Yeah. And definitely love this one. And I feel like I have talked about this before in our canonical faves, I think. It was in one of our series where we each talk about a book we love. You talked about Faust and I talked about No Exit. So if you want to hear more about that, a little bit more of a cohesive and in-depth discussion on it, check that out.
Yes. And I'm going to apologize also, August, you made me think of this. I didn't write down any of the translators for my books, but I'm sure there are many great translations out there. So sorry about that, guys. Mm-hmm. But my second honorable mention is The Brothers Karamazov. I always butcher that. By Fyodor Dostoevsky. The reason this is honorable mention, even though I really, really like this book, is because I listened to it as an audiobook, and I do not recommend that for this text.
Yeah, I feel like any Dostoevsky wouldn't make a fun audiobook.
There were moments where I was just like taken by the beauty of it, and they're like, there are a few lines that come to mind sometimes, but I really couldn't give you like any analysis of the text.
Okay. Well, we should buddy read that. I've only read Notes from the Underground and The Double by Dostoevsky, so I need to expand that. So
I would definitely do that.
Hell yeah. Cool. My next honorable mention is A Man Called Uwe by Frederick Bachmann. I did not write down the translator for this one. I apologize. I did for most of my top five. This one is one that I read recently this year. It's the first book by Bachmann that I've read. I know he's not for everybody, but I really enjoyed this one. Listened to the audiobook and was just like immediately sucked in. And I really want to listen to Anxious People. I think it might actually be the next audiobook that I listen to.
Oh, yay. Let me know what you think of that one, because that's on my summer TBR still.
Nice, nice.
Okay. My last honorable mention is The Iliad by Homer. Published in ancient Greek originally. What else can I say? It's a great epic. I do want to reread it. Feels very just like top of mind lately because I've been reading so many classical retellings.
Yeah, I love the Iliad and the Odyssey.
Yeah.
Are we wild about the Aeneid? How do you feel about the Aeneid?
I honestly think it's pointless. Pointless is harsh, but.
Yeah, that's really rough. Not like it's about the founding of Rome or anything.
I'm sorry to any Italians listening. That's not what I meant. I just
feel like a dick. Aeneas is gonna come and he's gonna just beat the shit out of you.
Do what I fucking dare you.
I'm not wild about that one either. I'm more into the Greek epic than the Roman epic.
Yeah, I just think like especially after like I mean, I love the Iliad. I think I do prefer it over the Odyssey because it's like war and drama. And August just made a no face.
I love them both, but like yeah. The Odyssey.
I mean, Odyssey's great. Obviously, they're classics for a reason. The first mm-hmm. classics. But I just, to me, the Iliad is just like, okay, this happened.
Here's some war. Here's some angry gods. Yeah. Iliad's yeah. tight. I like the Iliad a lot.
Yeah.
My final honorable mention is Persepolis by Marjane Satrapi. Believe that's how you pronounce their last name. This book, I believe, was originally written in French, I think. Yeah, because yes, the film is in French as well. I've talked about this book so often. This is a great graphic novel, probably one of my favorite graphic novels. I just love a memoir already to begin with. And this really kicked off me reading more graphic memoirs. So I read this, then I read another one. It's called Marzi, which is a story of a young Polish girl living in Poland during the time where it was a USSR occupied country or USSR based country. And then also Fun Home, which is a great memoir. I'm forgetting Alison Bechtel, I believe. And I can't remember who wrote Marzi, but I read all of those because of Persepolis. And yeah, if anybody knows any great graphic memoirs other than the three I just talked about, please let me know because I would love to read them.
My Friend Dahmer.
Oh, I do want to read that. I've seen the movie though.
Mm-hmm. Also, I think you like From Hell, yeah, by Alan Moore.
Okay, nice. Thank you.
Yeah.
I know that you have that, so I'm going to just take it from your shelf next time.
Honestly, it's massive. Take it whenever you want. You know how you asked me about books that I forget are translations? Mm-hmm. Persepolis is that one. When you said that, that's why my jaw dropped, because I was like, duh, that's such a good book.
Mm-hmm. It's so good. Easily, like, we read Persepolis when we were in an undergraduate class together on literature and the adolescent reader, and it was my favorite book of that class without question.
Easily, yeah, so impactful.
Mm-hmm. Love it so much. Okay, all right, we ready?
Oh, we're ready. You want to hear my number five?
Hell yeah. What's your number five, Kendra?
The Name of the Rose by Umberto Eco, which was originally published in Italian. It's from the 80s, or the book was from the 80s, but it's a murder mystery set in a monastery in Italy in 1327.
What?
August, wait until I give you this description, because this is so, like, up your alley.
I am blown away just from what I've gotten so far.
So I read this in one of my medieval literature classes, which is really fun because we'd been working with actual medieval texts the whole year. And she was like, I'm going to throw this little fun novel in there for you. And one of the reasons is because we were studying semiotics, which are the study of signs, in the class. And this book itself is extremely intellectual. Like, some, I love it, but it can get a little frustrating at times because he's trying to, you know, when people are being confusing for the sake of being confusing, and by people I mean really smart authors. Mm-hmm. That's what he does a lot in this book.
One August, of my favorite things.
I think you're really gonna like this because, well, part I really like about it is that the author uses semiotics for biblical analysis, for medieval studies. Like, he actually studied medieval texts and stuff, and he uses a lot of literary theory in the writing of it. And you need to use all of those skills. So that's why I say it's a very intellectual text, because mm-hmm. you're trying to unravel this mystery that you might not fully get the whole thing of if you don't have a firm grasp on semiotics. So I'm not saying you have to have a literature degree or like to get this book, but I would Google the study of signs. Mm-hmm. and see if that will help you piece together what happens. It also uses meta narratives, which I don't like, but I think August really likes.
I love them.
Yeah. So that always bothers me, but mm-hmm. if you like that, you're going to love this book. And the language in the text is really ambiguous, which is why it's number five, because I respect the book a lot, especially because it's brilliant. Mm-hmm. But as I've said, it's a little annoying to me. But it's postmodern as fuck, so I think August would really enjoy
it. Love it.
So a thing that's really interesting is that, like, Eco uses, like, I think the quote I remember from class is, like, he uses the modernist quest for finality, for answers, for completeness, and turns it on its head completely, like just subverts all those tropes. Love. By leaving a plot that's very bare bones and very what you think you're going to go into it and be able to solve it and understand exactly what's happening with a detective structure, but it's broken. It's like inherently just flawed. And so there's a chaotic pattern to it where you arguably could come with one answer, but maybe your classmate or your friend might have a completely different answer too. August is like really excited.
I really want to read this. Wait, what is this book called again?
The Name of the Rose by Umberto Eco. I don't have a copy anymore because I didn't move back with it, but I would reread it. I think reading it in a week was too much because it was grad school. So they're like, hey, here's a book you got to read in 5 days. Mm. And so I kind of rushed through it.
Okay, nice. Makes me think of just like talking about like detective fiction being like flipped on its head. I don't know if you've ever read anything by Thomas Pynchon.
No, I haven't.
He has a book called Crying of Lot 49, which is at times a detective-like story and is flipped on its head, but that's just Pynchon being Pynchon. Postmodern as fuck. We love to see it, or I love to see it, maybe not you.
It's okay. I
don't know why I asked if you would read Pynchon. He's like everything you hate. In
I respect it.
So, but he's in The Simpsons, so.
Oh, okay. Well, now you've sold me.
Yeah, well, it's because he's a known recluse, and so that was his little being like, I'm here, bye. Never talk to me again. But that sounds really fucking tight. I would love to read that. Yeah. Do you think that there's any like guidebooks out there for helping people who maybe don't have that foundation with literary criticism or the study of science?
There for sure is. I'm so sorry. I can't remember. I just know that my professor, she just like kind of printed out one for us. Like, I don't know if she made it herself, but I say that and like, you can still read this book and enjoy it, even if like you really don't have experience with these kind of texts. Okay. The reason I just bring it up is that there's just so much richness to it that everyone might not be able to pull out if they're not told it's there.
Mm, okay. Damn. Making a note of this.
Wow.
I'll read this soon.
Wow.
That sounds so good.
Yay. I'm glad. Well, I also want to hear about your number five.
So you know who, you know how I said that we were going to talk about Camus soon?
Oh, I sure do.
Here we are. We're going to talk about The Plague.
Living it.
Yep. We literally are. I was reviewing this book. I read this earlier in quarantine because why not? And wow, so many parallels to the modern day. So just some background. The Plague was written by Albert Camus in 1944. And it's told from the perspective of a man living in the French Algerian city of Rouen. And this is a city that in actual history had been devastated by plagues before, including the bubonic plague. So it's a long history of being just entirely decimated by disease. And this is a story of somebody, I believe it's taking place in the 40s as well, where there is a plague raging through the city once more. You see the beginnings of the plague when people first start to become sick and infecting others up until, you know, people are dying at a mass scale. People are trying to escape the city walls because they've been quarantined. Really an interesting book. I read this for the first time before COVID. Reading it now during COVID had a very different experience, maybe relating it more to the actual events happening around us and seeing how panic and fear really impact how people act towards one another during times of crisis like this. It was originally written in French. I do not have the translator, but let me pull it up. I also just got a really nice used edition of this book, which
gorgeous
makes me inspired to read it once more. So the translation I have is by Stuart Gilbert, and I have the Vintage Books Random House edition.
That's a gorgeous edition.
Yeah, isn't it nice? Local library box. Nice. Yeah, donate your books, share books with others. And that's my number five pick. What's your number four?
So mine is actually Beowulf, which, as we've mentioned, is actually Old English, which is closer, which it's Germanic. So it is not, there's no foundation for English in Old English, which is a very common misunderstanding. Okay, so it's an Old English epic poem in the tradition of Germanic heroic legends. So the structure is very, very long and uses alliterative lines that doesn't really translate to English, but there's some really beautiful lines in there still in modern day English. And it's part of the oral tradition, and it's about a hero called Beowulf who just does what heroes do. Think of the Odyssey. Think of like he's slaying monsters. What's really interesting to me is that there's a lot of, because I studied this also in my medieval class. Sorry, this is the last medieval thingy. August just left. I promise. I will say that I do think Beowulf is really valuable. I just don't think you need to read the whole fucking thing. But what I think is really interesting about it is there's really no clarity among scholars of whether it was composed in early pagan times in what is now Britain, or if, and by composed, I mean taken from the oral legend, which was pre-Christianity and then written down. So I should have been clear about that, and written down while they were still practicing paganism, or if it was after like the Christians came and colonized pagan times. What are words? I'm rambling. So this is important because if it was composed earlier, then the paganism is central to the whole text, and the Christian elements were added later because there were a lot of Christian elements to the text. But if it was composed later in writing by a Christian, then the pagan elements could just be decorative. So that means someone's trying to pull in someone who's not necessarily Christian and convince them to be. That's nice. That's my rant. I think everyone should read a little bit of it.
And there's like a really notable translator for Beowulf. Do you happen to remember their name?
I don't remember their name, but yeah, there's one translation that if you're going to write about it, you need to use that one. Look it up. Oh
yeah, I'll look it up.
I actually think while you're doing that, I actually think that like a lot of the old English poems are really valuable, like The Wife's Lament. Mm-hmm. A lot of the Anglo-Saxon poems are absolutely beautiful, and there's a lot of rich nature imagery.
It's translated most notably by Seamus Heaney in 2001.
Duh. He went to my school. He did.
Didn't he teach there too?
Not while I was there, but he did. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I even like Beowulf, and I am not a medieval person. I love learning about the monsters. Like specifically, I know everyone hypes up Grendel.
Yeah.
Fucking tight. Where is the retelling from Grendel's perspective?
I'm sure there's one out there. She's a bad bitch.
I mean, if it's not, I'm TMing that. It's mine now. My idea. Oh. Don't take it.
It's all yours.
Actually, Kendra should do it because I don't know enough about Beowulf, but that's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool poem.
Cool. So nice. What's your number four?
My number four is one that I read at the end of 2020, and it's a short story collection. Really made me want to read more short story collections. Still need to be on that. And that's Things We Lost in the Fire by Mariana Enriquez. And it's translated by Megan McDowell. It was originally written in 2016 and then translated in 2017. So relatively quickly after. And this is just a really interesting short story collection. It's perfect now that we have spooky time is upon us. It's, you know, it's August, so it's officially time to start getting those Halloween decorations out, at least in my household. So if you want something spooky, something that's ominous, definitely check this out. And so it's 12 short stories, most of them being incredibly spooky, and they use horror and supernatural stories to expose Argentinian history and political turmoil specifically. It's really, really interesting how it goes into that. There's definitely some stories that have stuck with me. Again, I read this at the end of last year, so it's a little foggy, but I know that my favorite story from this, when I was reviewing, I saw the title of this and I was like, that's the one. It's called The Neighbor's Courtyard. Messed up, really messed up. I listened to the audiobook of it, was very scared. It's like, you know, when you're like listening to like a scary YouTube video and you're home alone and it's like titled, like, don't watch this video when you're home alone, or like people that were hiding in people's houses and you didn't know, like that type of scary. That's the scary experience I had listening to this audiobook. So
what? I love that.
Yeah, it was really fun. It's also a really quick read. I don't know if she has any other short story collections out or even longer works, but need to be on that because truly love this one. I think I listened to it in a day.
That's wow.
How much I was into it. So.
Amazing. Okay, I need to read that.
Yeah, I think you would really like it.
I've heard really great things about it. Things We Lost in the Fire. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, awesome. I think it's available on Libby still. Might be on Hoopla as well. I'm not entirely sure about that.
Say Less. Add it to the queue.
Okay, so what's your number three?
And that's A Doll's House by Henrik Ibsen. And that was originally published in Norwegian. It's a play. I think I've mentioned it at some point. I just can't remember if I have.
I think we were talking about Ulysses because we were hanging out on Bloomsday in Dublin and we went to a lecture that was for free through the library. Yes. And it was on Joyce and Ibsen and it was the most boring lecture. Everyone was falling asleep.
This guy straight up snored and a snore woke him up. That was so funny. Yeah. I had a coughing fit. It was awful. Anyway, but the play itself is great.
That guy just wasn't the best.
It was just like we thought we were going to see a lecture on Ulysses and it wasn't mm-hmm. that. Anyway, but it's a really short social criticism of domesticity and patriarchy. Follows Nora and her husband and kids, who I don't remember their names of, so yikes, as she essentially has like a feminist awakening and realizes that, which I wouldn't say feminist awakening, she has an awakening, very much Coach Kate Chopin style, and realizes that being a wife and a mother is no longer fulfilling for her. Again, this is 1879, so not the norm. It was incredibly controversial. It has two endings. The original ending caused lots of outrage. I read this in, again, my AP Lit class, and it divided the class in half, the original ending. I prefer the original ending. I'll go on the record and fight for it. I think you should always read the author's original intended work, but especially because the ending is better. So Ibsen was actually forced to write a more obscure and very different ending, in fact, arguably opposite ending, in order for the play to remain on stage. So it's really great. I actually really want to reread it. I don't have a copy. So the next time we go to Green Apple, we're going to have to...
I feel like, I don't know if I've read any Ibsen in its entirety. I need to get on that.
Yeah, this is the only Ibsen I've read.
Okay, well, maybe we'll get a little collection together, have a little play moment. Or oh. Maybe go see a play.
Oh, I want to see a play so badly.
Everyone wear masks outside. Everyone be vaccinated so we can see plays again.
Yes.
And not die. damn, that sounds really good. It makes me think of, you know, talking about like censorship and authors being forced to change. My mind always goes to Oscar Wilde and The Portrait of Dorian Gray, which still is widely censored. The censored version is the dominant version out there. Everyone should seek out the uncensored version of that text.
Amen, sister.
Mm-hmm. Love Oscar forever. So my next pick is a play that you actually read recently, and it's The God of Carnage by Yasmina Riza, translated by Christopher Hampton. I love this play. I had to study and present on this play my first semester of grad school. It was like my big project for one of my classes for that semester. And so I spent a lot of time with this work and the film adaptation as well. Should just note that the film adaptation was directed by Roman Polanski, who is a notorious piece of shit. We do not support him. It is a really great film adaptation, and that's hard to say, like knowing that it's created by such a monster. So if you do feel compelled to watch it, pirate it. Don't let him have any access to money from it. Or you can seek out the play that was performed on Broadway here in the United States, which one of the actors, late great James Gandolfini, aka Tony Soprano, is in it. And I saw a recording of it and then it immediately got taken down. And wow, I miss that guy every single day. Love him. So excited for The Many Saints of Newark with his son in it. Beautiful. Love it. Love it. Love it. But The God of Carnage, just to go back to the play itself, maybe also try to pick this up used because Yasmina Riza is a defender of Roman Polanski. So just know that if you can get it used or online and not pay for it, maybe try to do that. But this play is really fucking good. So again, I'm sorry to be talking about it knowing that these people are not the best. It follows two sets of parents from different backgrounds. One family is incredibly wealthy. The other, not so much, more working class. And they're meeting because their two sons got in a fight at school that resulted in one needing to have dental surgery. The children are not there. It's the parents meeting to just kind of work out what's happened, like how they want to talk to their sons about their fight and where they can go from there. And it quickly devolves into just chaos. And it's really, really fun. I think that it's totally great. Yasmina Riza is also known for her play art. She's more known for that play, which is also pretty solid, but The God of Carnage and its portrayal of different peoples interacting with each other and how those interactions don't always go according to plan is why it is number 3 on my list.
Awesome. I did recently read that one. I'll rubber stamp everything August has said.
Yeah, really fun. Also, just bringing up the film adaptation again, John C. Reilly's in it, Christoph Waltz, Kate Winslet and Jodie Foster.
What? When did this come out?
Like the 2000s.
Wow. I was picturing an older adaptation.
Again, if you can pirate it, please get it. But this play only came out in 2006. So
nice.
That's when the English translation was done, I believe. So not that old.
Cool. I didn't know that. I should have because I just read it. So okay, so my next pick is actually Out by Natsuo. I don't know if it's Natsuo. Sorry. But it's Natsuo Kirino, which was originally written in Japanese. And everyone, please bear with me because this one is controversial to say the least. So if you've read this book and have a very strong reaction to it, I just want to say I hear you and I understand and I'm not going to convince you to read it or reread it. And I will give all the triggers in a moment. But I will say I really like this book. And it's, again, not something I would typically enjoy. But what I do enjoy about it is a scathing and bloody critique of neoliberalism and late-stage capitalism, which I very much enjoy. But it's done in the garb of a crime story, specifically a noir story. It employs and then subverts a lot of typical noir tropes, specifically the femme fatale, which we'll have complicated feelings about, I'm sure, understandably, because it gets icky and weird. And the trigger warnings for here are graphic, and I mean graphic, like capital G, all letters, graphic depictions of murder, dismemberment, and rape. And I'm intentionally using the word rape here because sometimes sexual assault isn't explicit enough, and I want you all to know exactly what you're getting into.
There's also kidnapping and like forced captivity, right?
Yes, abduction. I would argue torture.
I think most people would agree with you for torture with this, from what you've told me.
I would agree. It's just hard. The big controversy is the person experiencing this doesn't identify that, or eventually it's hard. It's really complicated and really icky. And I think it has a purpose that I can't get into without getting into spoilers, but that doesn't mean it's not hard to read. So I want you to know that if you're thinking about reading it, it's really uncomfortable. I read it in class for a class. And again, this is a text that split the class. There are people who are outraged it was on the syllabus. And there are people like me who are like, I thought this was a really interesting book. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I would argue for it.
Nice. What is it like essentially about? Like, oh, I know you don't want to give away too much.
Sorry, I realized I was like gushing about it and I forgot you need a synopsis. So it follows 4 women in Japan and I think Tokyo, and they work in a bento box factory. So a meat packaging essentially factory. And one of the wife's husbands is incredibly abusive, and she defends herself and kills him. And so she calls the other 3 gals up and is like, I need your help. We need to get rid of this body. So in the very early, like first 50 pages of the book, that's essentially the story. And they hide the body, and it's them kind of dealing with the guilt, with trying to hide, like the fact that they're murderers, like kind of a mob situation comes in. It's really interesting, really complicated, and overall, like very anti-capitalist. So we like that.
Love that. Yeah. I know you were telling me a bit about this last week. We briefly talked about it, and I was getting some like American Psycho vibes of it, from just like that critique of capitalism alongside intense gore and violent imagery.
So, yeah.
Which yeah. I love American Psycho, so definitely want to check this one out.
Definitely. I think you'd enjoy it. What is done to the bodies here is what capitalism does to the planet. So.
Mm. Rubber snapping, even though I haven't read it since you shouldn't, but I trust you with
Thank
what
you
have to say. Are you All ready right. for my number 2?
Dying to hear it.
I think it's pretty apparent. It's The Hour of the Star, which is a book that I read this year, and it is a solid 5 out of 5. This is by Clarice Lispector and was translated by Benjamin Moore. This short novella came out in 1977, and it is so good. I have talked about this before, but I desperately need to get my hands on the complete works of Clarice Lispector. There's a beautiful edition. I actually went to a bookstore yesterday and held it and like debated buying it. And I was like, I have too many books right now. I need to read through those first, be responsible. But I just like, I want it so bad. But I absolutely love this. This is easily going to be one of my favorite books of the year. Like, I'm saying it now, unless I read like 25 out of fives in the next couple of months, which who knows, maybe it will happen. But this is an interesting story, one that Kendra decided not to rate because she hates postmodern literature, and that's fine. But it opens with Rodrigo SM, who is a very interesting narrator. He is constantly interrupting the story that he is presenting as about to be told, constantly interrupting with just information on himself, him being distracted, which is something that I personally love. I love when a narrator just takes you out of the text and being like, oh, well, actually, let's talk about this for a minute. I don't know why, but that is something that just really makes me happy. And then once he eventually gets into the story, he shares the story of Macabea, who is a young woman living in poverty in Rio de Janeiro. She's 19 years old and incredibly naive. She doesn't understand the world as and how it works. She doesn't understand interactions with other people. She's just very lost and, again, very naive, as I would say a lot of 19-year-olds are, her more than many, I would say. And it gets into her life within the city. She lives in a slum and works in a slum as well, so going into that experience and also into her understanding of the world in which she lives, and how she is influencing and changing that world. She is really interested eventually in her on her impact on the world in which she lives. And it just goes into that, and it is really fucking sick.
It's a really well-written novella, I'll say that.
It's just not for you, and that's okay.
Yeah, which, yeah. I'm just glad it is for you, because your eyes light up when you talk about it.
It's so good. And I'm happy that you have at least read it and that you have that beautiful edition.
Yeah.
So it's with you. Maybe you'll change and grow to love it.
It's true. I'm not opposed to rereading it. It is like, I think I told this to August, where I feel like it was so postmodern that I was like just trying to grasp the story, where like if I went back and read it, I might enjoy it more. It might end up being like 4 or 5.
Okay. Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah.
And also like, don't feel pressured to read it. If it's not what you're interested in, like that's totally fine. Everyone likes different things.
Yes.
It's not like I'm going to be reading Beowulf anytime soon.
We'll see.
You better not make me. I'm putting my foot down.
No, I don't think I want to reread it, to be honest. As much as I was like, I've read it twice. That's good enough. Yeah, okay.
I had it the one time, and that's definitely enough for the time.
Yeah.
Hey, what's your next pick?
So my number one pick, probably a surprise to no one, is Anna Karenina by Leo Tolstoy, which
I'm not surprised at all.
I love this book so much. I think this is going to be the year I reread it. I've only read it once. And obviously this was published originally in Russian, and I'm not going to get into themes and not even a synopsis. I feel like it's like, you know, it's about an illicit affair, mostly because I really gush about this book in our all-time favorites. It's one of my all-time favorite books. I still would categorize it as that, I think. And I think it's important to mention it on the translation episode because language itself is so important to this text and so important to Tolstoy. So Tolstoy spoke 13 languages throughout his life. He was not so great at some of them, but really good at the other ones, which I kind of love. And he was just fascinated by languages. His main languages were Russian, French, German, and English. And this is reflected in all of his novels, but especially Anna Karenina, especially French. French being like the language of diplomacy and the language of the upper class. He really valued communication and saw, as an author, he saw it was his sole purpose to communicate ideas effectively across languages. Language is used in Anna Karenina as more than just a method to communicate. It also denotes relationships, which is my favorite thing about it. It also, there's a lot of deeper meanings in the type of words they use, even when they switch languages. And yeah, it's hard to, I'm trying not to give any spoilers. So I'll just say, if you don't know about Anna Karenina, it takes place in 19th century in Imperial Russia. So language, which is Russian, is really important to the identities of the characters. And throughout the story, Russia and the main character, Anna Karenina, go through stark changes. They really transform. And that kind of bleeds into the language, like the types of words they use. From my memory, I hope someone who hasn't recently read it go, what? I this was my impression of it. And I think you'll think of the Russian language as kind of, you know, closely reflecting the ideals of Russia, and that transitioning when she switches to French or to English occasionally, or even to like a less conservative form of Russian. And I'll also say, my last thing is, Tolstoy loved that his novels were being translated. There are a lot of authors who do not want their novels to be translated because they worry that it's going to lose the essence of their original language, especially when the Russian language is often set as a contrast to other European identities, especially like Western European. And so, but I just think it's interesting that Tolstoy just like, he waived his right immediately to translation because he wanted it to reach as many people across the world as possible. Okay. I know. And he wants it to be continuously translated forever. And it is. So I like,
so happy.
I know. Like, I really like that. Anna Karenina, that like, I've read one translation. I think the second time I read it, I might read a different translation because there are constantly people, academics specifically, who are coming forth with more translations because they think that they can get even like more rich language out of Tolstoy.
Love that. Yeah, I've never read that one and I really, really want to. I don't know if I've read any of the longer Tolstoy works.
I would read it with you, a heartbeat.
Let's make it happen. I also really want to read War and Peace because I saw that super long film adaptation that was just so fucking good.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I'd read it too.
Nice. Well, we should definitely buddy read those because as someone who loves Russian literature, I'm a piece of shit for not having read a lot of Tolstoy. But isn't the Tolstoy family like known for having so many artists in it and like just being like a very artistic and open Russian yes. like family?
Yeah, from my knowledge of it, yeah. Nice. All types of artists too, like even up to like photographers and writers. And
yeah, I know there's I think she's like a designer in the modern day. I can't remember her name, so I apologize, but I think she's a wallpaper designer and she's from the Tolstoy family. I
did not know that. Super cool.
I think they just did like an Architectural Digest video on her. I can't, who knows what I'm watching in my YouTube spirals.
Feel that. Okay. I'm dying to hear what your number one is. Wonderful. Well,
we're sticking with Russia, which is not surprising because this is a book that I don't know if we've talked about it a lot on here, but it's a book that I love deeply and intensely. And that's The Master and Margarita by Michael Bulgakov. I love this book. I'm a pretentious asshole and I have my favorite edition tattooed on me. Like, that's just how it is. I specifically like the translation by Mira Ginsburg. This is one where you have to be really careful with the translations. There are some bad translations out there. I'm thinking specifically of, there is one, Kendra has a couple editions of this. Can you maybe check? It's the one with like the string bookmarks, the black one.
Oh, modern, no, the Everyman's Library.
Yeah. So I know the Everyman's Library translation gets usually a decent amount of flack. Typically, it seems like they're not the best for translations. I know they also got a lot of shit for their Dostoevsky translations. So just be careful when you're looking out. I specifically like the version. If you can't remember the translator's name, there is the cat on the cover, Behemoth. So just look out for that version. It's green. He's on there. He's a cool cat. We love him. But this is a book that was published in English, I believe in 1967 originally. But interestingly, it was written from 1928 to 1940 and wasn't published in Russia until 1966. So the time of the USSR. And this book was widely censored. I don't even know if it was full. It was released in Russia at the time through a magazine from 1966 through 1967, which is after Bulgakov's death. So it's always sad, you know, when an author writes such a beautiful work of fiction and it's not able to be enjoyed during their lifetime. This is one of those situations. And this book follows a number of characters throughout Moscow during this time, during the Stalin era Russia. some of those characters being the devil and his posse, because guess what? They're visiting and they're going to stir the pot. I really loved the depiction of the devil in this book. I'm really surprised Kendra has not read it because it's the devil fetish. But specifically, I love Behemoth, who is a demon cat in it. And he is wild. He's a demon. He stirs the pot. It's great. He's a little cat. It's cute. Makes me really, really happy. Mm. But so it follows the devil and his friends, as well as a character named the Master and the Margarita. Don't want to get too much away there, but it is a very beautiful story at times. So that's one time period that it focuses on. It also goes back into the past to Jerusalem at the time of Pontius Pilate's trial. This is where I learned who Pontius Pilate is, because I was not raised religious. I listened to the Rolling Stone song Sympathy for the Devil, which is inspired by this novel, and he brings up Pilate in it, and I thought he was just talking about a pilot. Wasn't raised with religion. I'm sorry. It was confusing to me. And so it goes into his trial and the impact that he had on all that shit. I'm not the person to talk to about that because, again, no religion in this head.
He sentenced Jesus to the cross.
Yeah. I know that. Mm-hmm. But like, it goes into all of that. And it's also like post-sentencing. So okay, like him cool. like facing what he's done. Which is really interesting. And then relating that back to the devil being in the Soviet Union, stirring the pot, bringing good luck to some momentarily and a lot of bad luck to others. Just think it's really cool. There's a great scene where they're in a theater and the devil comes up on stage and puts on a little show. And then there's another great moment where they're playing chess. It's two demons. I believe it's Behemoth and a vampire character, because there's a vampire in this book as well. And they're playing chess, and it's Russian history through chess. So that is very interesting. This is the only book by Bulgakov I've read, and I absolutely love it. It's always on my nightstand. I have it right next to me. We'll flip through this book for joy, just any day of the week. Truly love it. It's so, so funny. In the past, I've compared the humor to that of like Don Quixote and Catch 22. If you like more historical-based satire, definitely would recommend this one.
Awesome. Good to know. I know. I need to read it.
We should read it together soon.
Okay.
It's so fun. And it's like a bit of a longer book. I think it's probably like 500 pages, but I mean, I read it over the course of like a vacation, probably like 2 weeks total. And it was really fun.
Yeah. Good book. Time doesn't mean anything to a good book.
And that's very true. Okay, so those are our top fives as well as our honorable mentions. Should we get into TBR?
Yeah, the only one on my TBR is Master and Margarita. Nice. And maybe a reread of Anna Karenina. Yeah, I don't really have like specific translations other than that that have been on my radar, but please send them my way if you think you've come across one you think I'd really like.
Nice, and same here. I have just some random ones. One that I would really like to read soon is Heart of a Dog, also by Michael Bulgakov, which was written in 1925 and then published in English in 1968. Love in the Time of Cholera by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Dead Girls by Selva Amada, which was translated by Annie McDermott in 2020. So a very recent work about, I believe, femicide. And then also, this doesn't really count, but Finnegan's Wake by James Joyce. Feels like it's in a different language. You have to have a fucking guidebook to get through it. And even then it's difficult. And I've had it in my Joyce stack for a really long time. So definitely want to get to that one.
Wow. A lot of great choices.
Yeah.
All right. So this was our translations episode. You know what to do. Rate, review, subscribe, wherever you're listening. If you're on Spotify, go ahead and follow. If you're on Apple, please subscribe. And if you can, take the time to leave us a written review. One, it just makes our day, makes us happy, but also it helps other people find our podcast the more written reviews we have. And it's a great place for feedback. We've tried implementing some of the feedback we've already gotten. So if anything that you think we can improve upon, please do let us know. And if you want to reach out to us any other way, I don't know where I was going with that sentence, but you can either email us at bookdumbpodcast@gmail.com, or you can find us on Instagram @bookdumbpodcast, or you can find us individually. And I'm Kendra @KendraLapp.
And you can find me, August, at Iggy Poop.
And that's all, folks.
Wow. Okay. Are you a rabbit?
I'm a Looney Tune.
Yeah, that's it. So here's our translation episode. Just again, like Kendra said earlier, if there's any translations that you love that you would like for us to read, please message us on Instagram. Let us know. We're, as we said at the beginning, looking for more translations to read, trying to expand our reading every single day with different languages, different, I don't know, just different texts.
Mm-hmm. Definitely trying to further diversify my shelf.
Nice. Me too.
Cool. Well,
thank you so much for listening. We hope that you're having a great day.
Bye.